יהיו לרצון נמרי פי בהגיון לבי לפניך אדוני, צורי וגואלי. שלום אליכם ברוכים הבאים. Welcome everybody. May the words of my mouth and thoughts of my heart be acceptable before you, Hashem, Rock and Redeemer. I am your host, Ariel Bar-Tzadok. You find me online at koshertorah.com. We are continuing our classes in the classical mystical traditions called the Kabbalah, from a book written in the 1500s. We are discussing the concept which we call the Sephirot. In our last class, we introduced this concept, understood it within the context of our author, and how these, in quotes, Sephirot, how do you translate that word? I mean, as we learned in our last class, it's subject to all different types of translations, so I'm just going to use it without translation. For those of you who don't understand, please go back to the last class, and if you haven't listened to it yet, well, stop the tape, go back and listen, just in case you're listening to this on recording. But anyway, moving forward, Sephirot are kind of understood as divine manifestations, right? Manifestations of God's light. God, the unknowable, revealed in the knowable universe. And as I was preparing tonight's class, and I was thinking about all kinds of different ideas and thoughts, I recognized that many of the concepts and the ideas that we call the Sephirot and divine emanations and the like, I would debate, and of course I would run into great opposition with certain extremist fundamentalist elements in the religious community. But for those who have a knowledge of history and philosophy and are honest and true about their religion will recognize that the concept and ideas of Sephirot and these ideas and demarcations may very well have had an actual influence from Greek philosophical literature. And that shouldn't come as a surprise, nor should that be in any ways a disqualification, because in all due respect, almost all of what we today call Judaism is subject to Greek influence. The entire way of understanding and analyzing Torah, which leads us to our halakha, comes from a Greek point of view, a Greek mentality, that which we call today pshat, an analysis. When we talk about these types of philosophical things, we must understand that Greek philosophical influence is clearly part of Judaism. The famous Maimonides, who is proclaimed to be the great rationalist, founded his entire book of Jewish understandings and insights on, or I should say comparing them to, Greek philosophical works. Of course, I'm speaking of Rabbi Moshe Maimonides, Rabbi Moshe ben Maimon, and his book, Moreh Nebuchim, The Guide to the Perplexed. That is a text, unfortunately, in my opinion, unfortunate, very much understudied today. No one likes to touch it. No one enjoys it anymore. I think that it's the Breslov Hasidim who've actually, disassociated from it. They put it in what's called in Judaism harem, which means they've excommunicated it because they just don't approve of that path. Well, you can approve it, disapprove it, whatever the heck you want, but its historical place in Judaism is well established and known. And my point for mentioning this is that you should find, or you will find, that as Maimonides used Greek philosophy and ideas and concepts, so did many of the Kabbalists. Indeed, that which we call philosophy and that which we can call metaphysics were all pretty much of the same schools. Aristotle was of one school, but before him was Plato, and before him was Socrates. And their influences and relationship with ancient Judaism is well documented, even in Greek sources. We know that Socrates came to the Holy Land and studied with many of the people there. Who taught who what? History does not document. We know that Alexander the Great, when he came to the Holy Land, traveled with Aristotle. And we know the interrelationship of our sages with him at that time. Now, although Aristotle was a student of Plato, I believe history documents that they were two different philosophies, but the interrelationship and weaving of the communities was in one way and at one time in the academic and the intellectual world well received, as opposed to as in the cultural world, which of course led to the Maccabean Wars and the great assimilations of the Hellenists and the like. It's a very, very interesting period in the history of the Second Temple period, but it's so influential that literally to this day, most of what we understand of Judaism is subject to that influence. Some have even gone so far as to say that this is actually fulfillment of prophecy, where in which it said that the father of the Greek people, who was Japhet, that he would dwell in the tents of Shem. It's an old prophecy, you know, Genesis book, you know, with Noah and the like. So many people interpret that to be that it was the Greek philosophy that was eventually embraced by the rabbis. Now, that is what it is. And this is the foundation of what we today call the philosophical Kabbalah. I emphasize this because side by side with the philosophical Kabbalah, which today in Hebrew we call Kabbalah Yunit, there have always been the older schools, based upon prophetic meditations, based upon outright interactions with angels and other forms and sources, and the books of which still exist to this day. However, they are very much censored, hard to find, and pretty much kiboshed, even, or I should say especially, by many of the modern day, in quote, Kabbalists, because it's not of their school, their orientation. Now that's important to understand. I've talked about this in many other places. But again, when we come to talk about the Sefirot as we are now, we must remember that the concept and ideas of Sefirot evolved. That's a correct and honest word to use. Now, the fundamentalists want to proclaim as loud as they can that the idea and knowledge of the Sefirot as it exists today came verbatim through the generations all the way back to Moses on Sinai, and that's just the way it is, black and white, no other word, and you don't agree, well, then you're so-and-so and whatever. Okay. I mean, you know, that is the way that fundamentalists believe about pretty much everything, and there's just kind of like no talking to them. But anybody who has an education recognizes that, you know, recognizes that for what it is, okay? And when you look at, as again, you said in the past, the Sefirot Sirah, earlier Spanish literature, Zohoric literature, then of course the ideas of the Arizal, and then later other schools, well, there's big differences between the schools of Chaim Vital and Yisrael Sarug, who were Talmud students of the Arizal. And then, of course, later came Rabbi Shalom Sharabi with the school of the Rashash. And then you had other schools after that. And everybody's got different ideas, and everybody's got different views, and everybody's convinced that theirs is the absolute right way, and everyone else is wrong. Okay. So be it. I want you to understand the Sefirot and the earliest form that I believe is proper and accurate that gives us the best internalization to make it real and applicable for our usage. And in that respect, I believe that the proper way of understanding this material is as it's been presented throughout the generations, throughout the centuries, as almost, if you will, they didn't use the word because it's a modern word, being psychological in nature. So, for those of you who got the live invitation to this class, you'll know that I entitled it Sefirot of the Mind. And I said colloquially, there ain't no other kind. I've had this discussion with many of my rabbinic peers, some of whom are big rabbis in their own right, who have a very different view of the Sefirot. And I just say no. I say, you know, I know you hold by a different view, but Rabbi the Baal Shem Tov, Yisrael ben Eliezer, he was of the Orient understanding of the psychological nature of the Sefirot. Our present author is, I am, and it follows back throughout the centuries. This was, in my opinion, and I believe it can be verified through history, the original understanding of the Sefirot. So that is why I teach them the way I do. Because like the verse in the book Job says, Mebasari achaza Eloha, from my flesh will I come to know God. Meaning, I learn about how I as a human being act, and therefore I can understand how I am created in the divine image, and therefore I understand more about the universe. I don't learn more about the universe by looking out. I learn more about the universe by looking in. Before we began our class this evening, when we were having a little private discussion, if you remember, I was discussing matters about prayer and how the proper way today to pray is, of course, with the quorum, 10 men and the like. And I said, my private observance, I always pray alone. Why? Because I'm never alone. Because the solitude and silence of communion, devikut, Kavana, is even expressed in many books on Jewish law to be primary and more important than the necessity of a quorum. The whole concept of a quorum is mystically based about the psychic bond on creation of, if you will, a miniature hive mind of 10 like-minded souls. I only wish that there could be such a concept, such a reality of unity today anywhere that is not artificial, superficial, or just plain phony. Let's turn to our text. Because as we speak about God, and remember, I don't talk about God as being an he. God is an it. That's the proper and correct way to look at it. We're talking about a revelation of what, from our perspective, we can only call nothing. Because from our point of view, it is above intellect. It is above intuition. It is above perception. It is above, above. It is something that we cannot even ascribe as being a thing, but it is something. So we call that something the nothing. And it is from that nothing that something came forth. That nothing is what we call the source. That is above. And from the nothing, like a candle lighting another, came forth a light. That's what we call the first light. In the Sephirotic language, they call it a keter, which is a crown. Now remember, a crown is not in the head, it's on the head. The symbol in the Kabbalistic tradition is that the skull represents the crown or the keter, because the brains are inside the skull and the skull surrounds it. So whether it's the skull, Galgalta, as it's referred to in Zohoric literature, or as the crown. It's a symbol of the great, unknown, invisible guidance. So, for those of you who might be into any form of modern Western culture, where in which you see skulls emblazoned on every which thing, originally, it might have been a sign of the motorcycle crowd or the occult crowd. It actually has a very deep and holy Kabbalistic significance, little is that known to those who would wear it. So it's actually amusing to see people misunderstanding such a fundamental symbol. But whatever. The first light, hidden, invisible. Our author here quotes and says that this, which again we call ayin, nothing, it is referenced right in the book of Psalms, very famous Psalm, Psalm 121, I lift up my eyes to the mountains, right? We translate the next verse as, from whence will come my help? In Hebrew, we are, those who know, it's me'ayin yavo esri, which means, me'ayin means from nothing will come my help. Not from whence, me'ayin means from nothing. And this is, he said, a reference to this great concealed level, which he says, no thought can ever grasp. All right? This is the ultimate concealed source of all. Now, in the later literature, the Arizal, he accurately, I mean, I have nothing but the greatest respect for Rabbi Chaim Vital's work, because I consider it the most brilliant exposition of human psychology. And when I've taught my classes on the Otzrot Chaim and the Etz Chaim, I mean, I've studied Jungian psychoanalysis, I've studied other school of behavioral and other therapies and the like. And when I read Chaim Vital, I sit there and with a big smile. I said, this guy really understood human nature. And he said, where did he get it? He got it from Elijah the prophet, or he made it up. Whatever. It's not the point. The point is the value. That's what's important. And this is the level, which again, we call the nothing. We say it's part of, connected to, God, the unknown. It's what we call the spark of the divine within us. And essentially, everything must have it. Whether you are a human being, or a dog, or a calculator. I have one of those on my desk here. I have a pencil sharpener too. Everything has to have a spark of God in it. Why? Because if it didn't, then it wouldn't be able to form the subatomic particles, which would then form the atoms, which would then form the molecules, which would then form whatever it is that it forms. That which is in the subatomic world that tells a quark or a string or whatever is down there, you are this, you are that, that's this indwelling spark. It's the seed. Can we find it? Can we discover it? No, we can't. It's called unknown and unknowable. And of all people, our great and holy Maimonides, the philosopher, writes about this in his Guide to the Perplexed, how certain things are just beyond intellectual comprehension. You can go into the Guide to the Perplexed, section 1 or volume 1, chapter 32. Got it right here open in front of me. I don't want to read so much of it because it goes on and on and on. He's very wordy, if you will. But he speaks about there are certain things in the intellect which are just far beyond what a person can grasp. And that's just the truth of it. And you can say, gee, Maimonides, the rationalist, and the Kabbalah and the Kabbalist, they're saying the same thing? It's getting back to what I said to you. Whether you're talking about Aristotle or Plato, they're both influencing here, like a well-weaved rug. Another point. We spoke earlier about how light emanates. We spoke about this in the previous lesson, in what we called form and force. Surah v'chomer. Maimonides also speaks about that here in the Guide to the Perplexed. And we will discuss this later in this course when we get to something right after the Sefer called the Du Partsufim, or the duality of the faces. In other words, what we're going to call primordial male and female. The primordial male and female, as we will see in our Kabbalistic literature, is a symbolic reference to the spiritual and the physical, or the force and form worlds. That's the symbolism. Where did that symbolism come from? Well, Maimonides, right here in his Guide to the Perplexed, chapter 17 of volume 1, he states that Plato and his predecessors are the ones who referred to the world of matter, the Homer's female, and the form, the Tsura, the force, as male. So there you go. Again, another overlap of source material. And I'm emphasizing this overlap because so many people today in the world of philosophy and intellect want to literally take what we call spiritual or Kabbalistic, i.e. metaphysical, and philosophical, and rip the two of them apart. Never the twain shall meet. Maimonides is the antithesis of Kabbalah. He's the enemy of Kabbalah. Kabbalah is the enemy of Maimonides, and yada, yada, yada. You know something? That is so academically incorrect. It's, in my opinion, insulting. I can read and learn Maimonides and learn as much about Kabbalah as I can by reading the Zohar, the Arizal, because I see the reflection, I see the wisdom in both. Granted, they use different terms to describe things, but they're describing the same. And if you recognize and see this, then you're not going to enter into the valley of the shadow of death, allow me to quote the psalm, wherein which you can enter into debate, argument, confusion, division, strife, which leads to hatred and argument, and all the rest of the dark side. Go learn what Master Yoda, Star Wars fantasy, has to say. Sometimes words of fantasy can be true too. But anyway, getting back to this. The first light, we call this primordial light. It says that this gave rise symbolically to the little, what we call the tab and the jot on the top of the letter Yud of the name Yud Kei Vav Kei. And it's not a full letter at all. And we also say that this is the name Ehyeh. You remember at the burning bush, God said to Moses, my name is Ehyeh, I will be. Why? Needless to say, we know that the term Ehyeh, Aleph Hey Yud Hey, is related to the foundational name Yud Kei Vav Kei, Hovei, Haya, are two forms of the same Hebrew verb. The name Ehyeh means I will be. Why did God say that to Moses? Because at the time of the burning bush, he was not yet active in being, which is what the name Yud Kei Vav Kei means, in the function and role of Redeemer. It was coming, and needless to say, it did come. So he says, Ehyeh shelahani elechem, I will be has sent me to you. And then tell them Yud Kei Vav Kei has come. And indeed, he does. Moving right along. I'm going to skip a little here for the sake of brevity of time. The second light. The emanation from the ultimate unknown. Let's think about this for a moment before we read. What is the point of diversion between the unknown? Where does the unknown become known? Or better to ask, how does the unknown become known? Think about it. Indeed, you can go into the darkness. You can shine a flashlight. But if you're going into the darkness and you shine the flashlight, what will be seen? Only that which the darkness conceals. Will you actually shine light on the darkness itself? Maybe those of you living in the city in an urban area have never had an opportunity to actually be in the dark. Try it sometime. The answer is no. Darkness, while we scientifically define it as the absence of light, it exists. Granted, you could shine light that will show you things that are concealed from the eye in the darkness, but the darkness in and of itself is still there, and you can shine light all you want. So all you're going to see is darkness. Therefore, the first thing to become known in the darkness is that which the light can see. That's the second light. We call it chokhmah, wisdom. Wisdom, I have to emphasize, is not an academic acquisition. You cannot go to school and get a degree in wisdom. Wisdom is life experience. It's an awareness, which I can give a whole bunch of descriptions to describe, and each one of them is going to be poetic. Here, I'll give you some examples. Wisdom is that proverbial light bulb that pops over your head when you get a brilliant idea. You ever stop? You have to think about something. What am I going to do? How am I going to do it? And you're sitting there, and all of a sudden, bing! A light bulb goes over your head. That's the image we see in all the cartoons and television stuff, right? Bingo! I got this great idea. That's chokhmah. When all of a sudden you have a feeling, different from an emotion, an intuitive sense of something that is right, something that is proper, something that is timely. And I've heard from many people, whether they are lawyers in court, doctors in surgery, they know what they're supposed to be doing, but out of the multiple choices of how something's going to be done, they just got a sense that this way is the right way. You can sit and analyze, intellectualize, try to philosophize. Well, why? I just got a hunch. Something inside you tells you. It's the birth of light in the dark. It's the origins of something out of nothing. Now, as modern science has clearly shown, there is no such thing as something out of nothing. Because as we've learned, even the nothing is something, but it's a something that's nothing, and you can go figure that out all you want. There's no such thing as spontaneous generation. As such, kind of confuses me how they can teach modern science courses that say, well, life originated on Earth as a spontaneous generation with chemicals joining to form, you know, the prefabrics of proteins and yada yada. Totally contradicting the laws of entropy, totally contradicting the laws of physics. But, you know, physics says that reality came into being by contradicting the laws of physics. Yeah, okay, I guess that makes sense for those who are asleep. That's why we play Reveille before we begin our class. Got to get you all to think. So, moving right along here. Chokhmah. Okay? This is the light. It has within it, it calls the power or the potential of the nine lights to come. Okay, this is the second light. We call it wisdom. All right, and he quotes here all different kinds of verses to show where wisdom is and what it is, etc., and so on. It's all very nice. But he states here something interesting and important. Shebemidah hazot, koach kol hatzurot, vehi hanotenet tzura lekol ba'al tzura mekoach insof. This is what I was referring to you moments ago, where it says that this attribute called wisdom, this chokhmah, is the potential within all force. And it is what gives every force, the tzura, to everything that's going to receive the force from the power of the unknown. As I gave the example a little bit ago, something tells a quark to be a quark. Something tells all the quarks to get together to form an atom. Something tells, or I shouldn't say it, form an atom, form electrons and protons and neutrons, which then get together to form an atom. Gotta be, you know, try to be precise here. Well, what tells this to do this and this to do that? Science will say, the laws of physics. Yeah, okay, got that, but you have just betrayed yourselves. Because if you say there are laws of physics, then by definition, logically speaking, there has to be a lawgiver. No, not with a guy with white beard, you know, white beard and white hair sitting on a cloud somewhere playing a harp. That's, we know, that's all fairy tale, make-believe, silly stuff. But obviously, somehow, somewhere, the laws of physics got to be laws by somehow. That's what we're talking about here. As I described to you a couple lessons back about what we call the secret of life, and I introduced to you the concept of biocentrism by Dr. Robert Lanza's book, this is what we're talking about here. The indwelling spark of God, the cancer, is the unknowable spark. It's unknown. It's unknowable. But it has to transform actually, from unknown to known, from concealed to revealed. And that spark, that ding moment, that's Chokhmah. That's the indwelling presence. For every force of nature, law of nature, there is something that tells it what it is. It's the life force within it. It's the consciousness and sentience that is within it. That is Chokhmah. It's in you. It's in me. It is part of our psychology. That's why I refer to this as the Sefirot of the mind. There ain't no other kind. Because to look, to try to see out in the world, where is the Sefirot? You ain't going to find them out there. They're inside us. They are the pattern and the form of all consciousness, all sentience, and therefore all life. You will find that even within the subatomic and molecular structure of the calculator on my desk, it follows the same pattern of atomic development and evolution, as does the atomic structure in each and every one of our physical forms, and underlying even in the world of force itself, which has its own higher reflection of relationship of energies. That's what we're talking about here. This level is called Reshit, the beginning. All right? Now, even though we say it's the second Sefirah, being that the first is so concealed that we call it nothing, this is the first that we can call something. It's the first level that can be grasped. And indeed, it can be grasped. This, he says here, is the hint to the letter Bet in the beginning. And he says that the Chokhmah, there is no knowable form to Chokhmah. This is the one that gives force to all force. And he says, the Hiyuli is a very interesting concept. Ramban Nachmanides speaks about it in his Torah commentary in Genesis. How God first brought forth the prima matter, and from the prima matter brought forth the four elements, fire, air, water, earth, which of course are the four forms of matter, plasma, gas, liquid, solid, and the fifth element, this prima matter, the Siuli. Even though we would say technically that corresponds to the Keter, ultimately that responds to the Chokhmah, which is the revelation. That is why, for those who know the later Kabbalah system of the Ari, we call this Atzilut, the source of all. This is the level which flows into, like a liquid, into all which is going to come later. As such, it's always fluid in form. That's why we call it force. What structure does... Oh, let me rephrase that. What form does a liquid have? The obvious answer is, well, it takes the form of whatever vessel it is in. Okay, but what is its form? None. It's always fluid. It's always moving. That's the nature of a liquid. Gas, same thing. Plasma, all the more so. That's Chokhmah. Now, Let's not physicalize this. Remember, what we're talking about here is a level of consciousness. Chokhmah is that brilliant light bulb that pops over your head. You cannot grasp it. You cannot control it. It will come to you when it wants to. It will take the form that it chooses. It speaks to us in our dreams and sends to our conscious mind the most weirdest, bizarre, upside down, inside out imagery, which our conscious mind just can't get. Carl Jung did a great job of understanding and analyzing dreams, and I recommend the learning of his material. He understood what we call the archetypes of the collective unconscious, how there are certain images and pictures that the mind, if you will, speaks in. This is the language of Chokhmah. The prophets of the Bible were the masters of this. When you look to Ezekiel and his chariot vision, everybody reads chapter 1 of Ezekiel. Go read chapter 10. Go read the second vision, where it says he was pulled by his hair in the spirit, and he saw all these things, clearly indicating, as does Maimonides later in his code, that this was all mental imagery. There is prophecy which is actual, physical and tangible, and then there is that which is mental imagery. That's the vast majority of it. But then again, the Book of Numbers said that, where God says he'd speak to a prophet in dreams of the night. We all dream. You do. And I know. I am reaching out through the internet, through time and space, to speak to you listening, live and recording. You, listen. You darn well know. You have had dreams. You've woken up in the morning knowing you had received a message. You woke up with a dream that you might not understand what the symbols were, but you know you received something. That's Chokhmah talking to you. Chokhmah, I consider to be like a programming language, that ultimately it speaks within our minds, even at the unconscious level, because it has no structured form. It literally speaks to the level of mind under our intellect, called the unconscious. And as a circumstance arises in this physical world, whether you are doing whatever, at a moment, a little unheard voice pops up inside your head saying, do this, not that. Do this right now, not that right now. You don't hear a voice. It's not like you have an inner dialogue, but you just know. And you act almost instinctually, almost as if you were programmed to act. And you, after the moment, recognize that that was the right thing to do. And you, gee, how did I know to do that? You just know because it is. I have here a question that's being asked in text. What if you have dreams and you know they're a message, but you don't know what the message is? That's exactly what I'm talking about. You don't have to know the message. You don't have to wake up, gee, I had a message and the message is. It doesn't work that way. I know for myself, personally, and I sit here like Maimonides tells us to, and I sit and I contemplate for hours and hours on end. Sit and I think, I daydream, I go off into visions. I use all the holy names, all the stuff and everything else, and I go off into all kinds of places. I see all kinds of things. Some of which I've shared in my writings and other places, and most of which I haven't. I've had dreams, usually at auspicious times like new moon, full moon. I've seen in a dream who's going to win the upcoming presidential elections. I have seen in dreams the future of what's going to be between Israel and Iran. Are they accurate? Are they prophecy? I don't know. I can tell you one thing. Nowhere did I ever wake up from any of my dreams compelled to say you must go forward and be the town crier and tell people this and that and that and this. I guess if I did, I would. I feel that way with regards to encouraging people to get out of urban areas and come back to a rural lifestyle. But regards to other little things, what difference does it make? Time will tell. I assure you, I am not a prophet. No prophecy today. I only wish that I could say God comes to me and says, "This is Hashem, thus saith the Lord." Da, da, da. Oh, I'd love, that would be great. I don't care if it was me the prophet, you the prophet, anybody. We should only have a prophet. Halavai, we say in Hebrew. Unfortunately, I'm too grounded to reality to suffer from such illusions of grandeur. So I can't lie to myself to think something so far removed from my reality. But I see what I see. And, like the question asked, I confess, I don't know what it means. I don't know if it's literal or symbolic, but I've learned, after doing this for 25 years or more, to sit, follow the words of instructions of our sages, recorded of all mystical places, the Pirkei Avot, the words of our sages. First words, Havu Matunim Badin. Before you make a decision, before you draw a conclusion, be patient, slow, take it easy. You will find, and here's some wise advice for you, don't go jumping. Take things nice and slow. And if you ever feel compelled that you gotta right now or else, chances are, take the or else. You know something, I'm gonna sit this one out. Let's see what happens. And you can say, oh, well, then you'll miss. Well, maybe you will. And I guess that there are times that you'll just have to be able to discern the difference between things. But the wisest course of action, like our holy sages said, don't be so quick. With chokhmah, the embrace of a fluid message can take many a form. I think modern science understands this very well by what they call quantum physics. That reality, when observed, that's bina, that comes next, it takes a structured form. But prior to its observation, it can take many a form. That's a law. Remember the laws of physics? It's a law of physics. It's a reality. It's the way it is. And so when it comes to structure, many things can be. Many a dream can take many a form in many a world and many a place. And who knows what's going to be? So therefore, when you see a vision or feel something, take it easy. Don't jump. When I tell people in an open invitation, consider Eastern Tennessee is a beautiful rural relocation from urban areas. Is that right for you? I'm not going to say that. Who am I? It may be. It may not be. So what do? You take it nice and slow. You come and check things out. And you do things right. And if something is meant to be, God's way is that the right means and the right hands will work the right way. Whereas in the opposite, the right hands, the right means and the wrong hands will cause the right means to work in the wrong way. In other words, if you're meant for something to happen, it'll happen. And if not, then it won't. You just have to be open. And as they say, go with the flow. You got to be in touch with that flow. So, in Torah, whenever we speak of what's called the fear of God, Yirat Hashem, that is called this level. All right? Because it's not fear, but it's awe. Awe is a feeling of, whoa, this is far bigger than me. That is chokhmah. And when we go into our meditative states to get into that state where we can sense things, kind of like shining a flashlight into the dark. I don't expect to illuminate the dark, but I do expect, because I know from experience, I find a lot of things in the dark when I look there. So I turn on the inner light, it's a good visualization, and all of a sudden an idea, pop! Just like an animal scurrying through the woods. Oh, there it goes. I know I saw it, but now it's gone. That's the way chokhmah is. It's always fluid. It's always flowing. And there's a way that I teach this in the Sefer Yetzirah course of how to grasp these things, how to do what I call mentally digest these things so as to be able to grasp, embrace, and make them real, which is why, again, I emphasize why concepts of the Sifi world have to be psychologicalized, internalized, so that it becomes real to you as well. That is the original way, and how we tap back into the ways of the prophets. Now, moving right along, and we're running out of time, but we still got some time left. The third, the triad, is called Bina, translated as understanding. We call this the second light to Keter. It comes out of the first. It's the actual third light, right? And we say, this is here, I'll read to you. Hi hatchalat ha-pe'olot hen ladin hen l'rahamim. Meaning, ki hi ha-notenet ko'ach l'ma shilamata ha-men lif'ol kol ha-pe'olot. This is the beginning of action. It says here whether it's for judgment or for mercy. I'll explain that in a second. Because this is the source which comes forth the potential to give everything beneath it the power to perform. Leave all kolopo'olot to perform all the functions. All right? To be. Bina is that which we know as the intellect. It is that part of the mind which gives structure and form, concrete form, to that which previous was fleeting. So, once I get that brilliant idea which pops out of the darkness, I gotta actually sit and digest it. I gotta think about it. What exactly does that mean? And I be patient. And I wait. And I allow an idea to grow in my mind. This is understanding. This is when the tsura, force of thought, takes on the form, the chomer, of thought. Not physical. Thought is still not physical, even though it is actual. It's something. Thoughts are things. And this process, this triangle between the Keter, the Chokhmah, and the Binah, this is the realm and the domain of mind, of thought. Binah gives construct. Binah is the intellect, the rational, that which you and I know, what we are communicating with right now. It is interesting, but when one reads Talmudic literature, which deals with rational intellectual discussions in a very philosophical way, morals, ethics, and the like, when the sages wish to introduce a logical and rational understanding of material, they introduce it with the term ta shma, come, listen. In Zoharic literature, which is more poetic than prose, regardless of whether it's from Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai or not, the type of material is of a very different philosophical orientation. Its introduction is not with the words ta shma, come and listen. Rather, it introduces the words ta chazeh, which means come and see. What's the difference between seeing and hearing? Well, they say a picture's worth a thousand words. So which would you rather have? An essay with a thousand words written on a page, which you better pray you understand the language and you're able to read, or a picture, which carries more depth? You might say the picture. Well, intellect, bina, is the construct and form of mind. It relates to words, which again are constructs in form. It relates to ideas which are concrete. If I say apple, you know English, then you know what an apple is. You can picture it right now in your mind. When I give you examples of things I have on my desk, calculator, pencil sharpener. You know what these things are. You can picture them in your mind. Tell me, what kind of calculator do I have? Pocket calculator? Full calculator? Battery operated or electric? What kind of pencil sharpener? Electric? Hand? What color is it? You don't know those details now, do you? But if I showed you in a picture, boom, all that would be known. Pictures speak a language which words do not. That's why the chokhmah part of the mind, the unconscious, that fleeting, flowing movement, is always pictorial, what Carl Jung refers to as archetypal. Whereas the intellect, bina, is always rational, logical, full of construct form. That is the way we have to understand that the two of these form an intimate relationship. These are called the mochin. He states here that in the Torah, the name referring to Bina is called Yudke Vavke, Hashem's name, but with the vowels of the name Elohim. And there's all kinds of reasons for that. And he says Bina is how the heavens and the earth were established. The name Elohim, with even though it's Yudke Vavke with the vowels, this is the name that was involved here with creation. Creation, again, was the construct of form. Okay? Somebody here states that they think in pictures, not words. You know, it's very interesting if you ever watch some of these science programs, and I love watching them. They had programs about like autistics and special type people who think differently, wherein which, I remember they were speaking to this one individual who could calculate the value of pi to like 1,000 places in his mind. He does like these amazing mental things. And they wanted to know how he was doing it. And as they were interviewing him, he described it as saying, well, it's not like I'm doing actual calculations in my head. It's like I'm seeing pictures, images, colors. And I know that these images and pictures and colors, this one means this, this one means that. I just know it. That is chokhmah. Now, why does his brain operate like that and not yours and mine? Gee, that's a good question. That's what science is trying to understand. But the meditative intuitive process and the likes of the meditative courses that I teach is cultivated specifically to help us exercise our minds to develop these skills. And I don't think anybody's ever too old. I don't think anybody's ever too unholy. It's psychology. It's human. It's inherent. It's natural. That's just the way it is. So, he writes here, "V'nikrat Elohim b'kol ma'aseh bereshit shehu l'shon din." That whenever we refer throughout the creation process, we have the name Elohim there, and we say that that is din. Din is the word for judgment. We always speak of the dinim, severities. But you have to understand exactly what that means. It does not mean punishment, evil, bad, wrong. Rather, it means structure, form, concreteness, rigidity, limitation. We live in a world of din, judgment. Why? Because everything here, like we said, takes an isolated and individual quantum application. In the original quantum state, like they learned with particles, things can be in two different places at once, two different times, two different places, but yet when observed, all of a sudden it becomes one. Non-observed? Chokhmah. Observed? Bina. Now don't get confused with the observed and non-observed, with the, you know, come and see thing. You know, we're talking against symbolisms here, so don't get confused with that. But when you pay attention, you're literally crystallizing and making something that was grandiose and fluid into something rigid and tight. This actually is very applicable to the understanding of Torah and Jewish law. Originally, the oral traditions of Judaism was forbidden to write them down. They had to be oral. Why? Because they were always subject to flow and movement. But during the course of the days after the destruction of the temple, when you had literally a century of persecutions and problems, the great sages of the day, all who were master mystics of the like, indeed foresaw in their psychic and intuitive abilities that if they didn't write these things down, they could be lost. They were terrified to do so because they knew if we write things down, then it's going to transform from a liquid to a solid. And indeed, that is exactly the danger that happened. The sages were aware of this. And that is why, for hundreds of years after the writing of what we call the Mishnah, the redaction of the oral traditions, we have centuries of discussions and talk and ideas codified, first in the Holy Land of Israel, what we call the Talmud Yerushalmi, and almost a century later, codified in greater form in Babylon by what we call the Talmud Bavli. And for anyone who has ever studied Talmud, you recognize very clear, there is no redaction, this is the law, A, B, C, D. No. The Talmuds discuss things. They reconstitute the fluid nature of things. And very rarely do they ever get quantum that they limit things down to one. They keep things fluid so it can be either or, depending on the circumstances. And that is why you have rabbis who come to the Talmuds, and one in Europe reads it and understands it in one way, writes his commentary and ordains law to be practiced in his community in one way. Whereas a rabbi thousands of miles away in North Africa or in the middle of Asia in places like Persia or Baghdad reads the same exact words of the Talmud and draws from it a different conclusion and writes up laws of practice in different forms and structures for their communities. And both or all three or all ten are right, correct, and quantum. That is the underlying meaning of Elu ve'elu divrei Elohim chaim. These are the words of the living God. Because they're all fluidly connected. And that is why we take such strong stances against all of these, what I consider wannabe cult leaders who call themselves rabbis who don't deserve the title, who read some English book and say, this is law! And everyone else is wrong! No, they're not. I, for example, am not a Lubavitcher, but I recognize Lubavitch has its way. I, for example, am not a Breslover, but I respect Breslov, but Breslov has its way. There are other schools and other ways, and in the fluidity of the reality of the bond and relationship of Chochmah and Bina, everything has its time, everything has its place, and this is the way things are. That is why the Torah path, like we say, there are 70 faces to the Torah, and some say even 600,000 faces, depending on the, you know, symbolic number of souls that left Israel, Egypt at the time. Everyone has their own ways. So today, when a layman comes to try to say, what is the path of Torah? You'll have Rabbi A who says you have to do this, and Rabbi B who says, no, you can do that. Is gelatin kosher or not kosher? You ask a Ashkenazi rabbi, he'll say, certainly not. You ask a Sephardic rabbi and he'll say, certainly yes. You go to an Ashkenazi home, you're not going to see Lucky Charms. You go to a Sephardic home, you very well might. Who's right? They're both right. Well, is it kosher or it's not? It all depends how Chochmah flows into Bina. In one way, it flows one way that says forbidden. And in the other, it flows the other way, which says it's Mutar. Well, that's so confusing. No. That's reality. That's why you and I are different. And yet, fundamentally, we are connected and the same. That's the great secret here that you must understand. Just to summarize this up, because as you know, time dating us, we're not going to have a class next week because of the high holiday. This is called Olam Haba, our sages say. This is called the level of the world to come. It is also called Teshuvah, repentance, or return. Why is this the world to come? Because when you look at the promises of the Messiah, it says in Isaiah, the lion will lay down with the lamb and all the rest. Some interpret that in, symbolically. Others say, no, it's going to be real. That the entire fundamentals of quantum reality are going to shift and change, where we're going to have mutual contradictory realities being able to merge together. This is called return. Where in which the mind returns to the higher connections where it can attach to God. Remember, God is that spark in the Keter. He reveals himself in the wisdom. And it's for us to extract that into the Bina. So the path is to go from the Bina, deeper into the Chokhmah, ultimately into the Keter. Now, in the words of Rabbi Moshe Cordovero, I'll sum this up. He says, with regards to Bina, you can ask a question and indeed receive an answer. With Chokhmah, you can ask a question, but it's above an answer. And with Keter, there is not even a question, certainly no answer. That is the nothing. Maybe I've described this well. Maybe I've explained it decently. And then again, maybe not. Because ultimately, this is not a course in philosophy. This is a course in reality. And as such, I want to sum up to you. And these are the words. That the Holy One, blessed be He, recognizes His truth. And He knows it as it is. He does not know with a knowledge which is external to Him in the way that we know. For ourselves and our knowledge are not one. But rather, the Creator, may He be blessed, He, His knowledge, and His life are one from all sides and corners in all manners of unity. Were He to live as life is usually conceived, or know with a knowledge that is external from Him, then there would be many gods, Him, His life, and His knowledge. But that is not so. Rather, He is one from all sides and corners in all manners of unity. Thus, you could say, He is the knower. He is the subject of knowledge. He is the knowledge itself. All is one. Does that sound mystical to you? Or philosophical? Or both? That's a quote from Maimonides in the Laws of the Foundations of Torah, Chapter 2, Law 10. And go look it up. God is all. He is the knower. He is the known. He is that which is the knowledge itself. As it is above, so it is below. Where in which ultimately we come to the realization, which isn't an intellectual concept, but more like a sensing. Beyond consciousness, like a programming within. Ein od milivado. There is none other than the one reality underlying it all. And everything flows from it like the waters of an ocean. And then they take form and structure as the waters flow out of the ocean into the rivers and the rivers into the streams. And that is our reality. Our purpose is to return to the great ocean, to dive into its depths. And on that note, I'm going to conclude. Hey, we're finishing off the year 5772. May God bless us all with a happy and a healthy and a prosperous new year. One that I pray shall be a true return, where we can return up the streams to the great ocean. Bina, the mind, is called the mother, and Chokhmah is called the father. The two
when merged together in proper intimate union, bear children. And those children we call the attributes. And that'll be the topic or discussion in our next class, God be willing. May God bless you all. Thank you all for joining me. Happy New Year. Good night. Shalom.